becoming instrumental in creating the satisfaction in the mind. That is a very great secret. How is it possible that a passing connection of the mind with an externally placed object can become the source of happiness within? This happens on account of the presence of something which the mind cannot cognize. And as long as the presence of this particular something is not recognized, there would be sorrow as the outcome of this external relationship. There is a notion in the minds of people that happiness arises on account of the contact of the mind with the desirable objects. This is not true, is the great point that is made out here. Happiness does not arise on account of merely the contact of the mind with the object which is desirable. For this purpose, another question may have to be answered. We shall leave aside for the time being the question as to how a desirable object becomes instrumental in creating satisfaction in the mind. Why does an object appear desirable at all is a primary question. Then comes the question how it becomes instrumental in creating happiness. The desirability of the object is again a condition of the mind. It is a perception by the mind in the contour of the object, certain characters which are necessitated by the mind. The mind is a pattern of consciousness. You may call it a focused form of consciousness. A shape taken by consciousness. Something like a shape that the waters of the ocean may take in the surge of the waves. A particular arrangement of consciousness in space and time may be said to be a mind, whether it is a human mind or otherwise. This particular arrangement of the mind is naturally finite because of the fact that it is particular. Every particularized shape or form is finite merely because of the fact it is so particularized. The particularization of the mind means the isolation of that character of the mind from other characters which are equally possible. When I say there is such a thing called red, it means there can be other things which are not red. So a particular state of mind becomes finite in its nature on account of other such conditions or different conditions being made possible. So the finitude of the mind becomes a source of restlessness to the mind. Every restlessness psychological is due to a finitude felt in the mind. What is finitude? A sense of lack. A limitation that is imposed upon itself by the factors of finitude itself. You want to overstep the limits or boundaries that are set upon you. So the mind tries to jump over its own skin in trying to grab objects which it imagines to have the characteristics which are the counterparts of what it lacks. The finitude of the mind can be made good by the characters that the mind imagines to be existent in the objects that are desirable. It imagines for certain reasons that a particular object or a particular group of objects, certain sets of circumstances are made in such a way that they have characters which are exactly the complement or the supplement or the counterpart or the correlative of its own finitude. Or you may say it is something like a square rod beholding a square hole in its presence of a similar shape. If a square rod sees a round hole, there cannot be attraction. If the round rod sees a round hole, there can be attraction. There should be counterpart of values. One finitude should be capable of being made good by another finitude. The world is made in such a way that there are infinite varieties of finitudes. And one set of values which go to make up the finitude of a particular mind become the sources which summon the opposite of these values which are in the mind. So the world is said to be relative in the sense that everything is related to everything else. Unless a particular finite situation is related to another particular finite situation which is going to be the complementary aspect of it, there cannot be fullness. The sense of fullness is the source of satisfaction. Satisfaction and the sense of fullness are identical. When you feel incomplete in yourself, you are unhappy. When you feel you are complete, you are happy. The incompleteness arises on account of the notion that something is lacking in you. The sense of lacking arises because there is a sudden emergence of certain notions in the mind in respect of values of which it becomes conscious. And so it cannot be that a particular person will be feeling the same sense of finitude at all times. It does not mean that you will be wanting the same thing throughout your life. The idea of finitude goes on changing as you rise in the process of evolution. As the mind gets transformed gradually, stage by stage, in the process of evolution day by day, the requirements of the mind also change. And so it is that every day you desire different objects, not the same object. You cannot give one thing today and say forever you should be happy. That is not possible. Because the mind cannot rest in one condition. It cannot rest because there is evolution. There is a physical evolution and psychological evolution both taking place simultaneously. So this perception of a counterpart of the finitude of a mind in a given condition is the reason behind the perception of the desirability of an object by the mind. Then what happens? Immediately the mind feels, here is the source of my fulfillment. And so immediately it wishes to come in contact with it so that it becomes a part of its being. The desire of the mind for a particular desirable object is a desire to get united with that object in being. So the idea of possession is something very strange indeed. It is actually a desire to get united with that object so that you become physically, psychologically whole in being and not merely in external relation. Because this beingness is not possible, you cannot enter into the being of any object, there is no satisfaction even after the fulfillment of a desire. No desire can be fulfilled eternally, whatever be the effort that you put forth, because it is not possible for you to enter into the being of that object. The intention is good, but it is impractical. Nobody can enter into the existence of an object because the object is externally placed in space and time. So it is a futile attempt on the part of the mind to enter into any object. So there is a struggle on the part of the mind to possess the object, to become the object, to make it a part of its being by assimilation of its being into its own. But it is a fruitless attempt because the operation of space and time will prevent the entry of one into another. So this world is a sorrow and it shall be a sorrow. There shall be a perpetual effort on the part of people to grab objects and try to enjoy them, but they cannot enjoy them. There can be an appearance of enjoyment, really it cannot be. The love that you feel in respect of an object is the love that you feel towards that which is called perfection and completeness. It is not a love for the object. You have thoroughly misunderstood the whole point. If when you are clinging to a particular object as if it is the source of satisfaction. The mind does not want an object. It wants completeness of being. That is what it is searching for. And so, when there is a promise of the fulfillment that it seeks, through the perception of an object that appears to be its counterpart, there is a sudden feeling that fullness is going to come. And there is a satisfaction even on the perception of that object. And there is an apparent satisfaction again on the imagined possession of it. So what is it that you are asking for? You are not asking for any object or thing. You are asking for a condition of completeness in your being. So, my dear friend, says Yajnavalkya, nobody is dear. No object can be regarded as affectionable or desirable. It is something else that you are asking, and by a notion that is completely misconstrued, you imagine as if the object is love. So what you love is a completeness of being which is reflected in the condition which you seem to create between yourself and the object concerned. Very well, you must mark this point. What you love is only the condition that you imagine to be present in the state of the possession of the object. But that state can never be reached for the reason already mentioned. So, nothing is dear in this world. What is dear is a condition which you intend to create or project in your own being by an imagined contact with the object. So not one person is dear in this world, but what is dear is that condition which you imagine to be present after the possession of that object or the relationship with that object. Now, what are these objects? Every blessed thing. Yajnavalkya goes on with his herring to Maitreyi. Neither the husband is dear to the wife, nor the wife is dear to the husband. What is dear is a condition that they try to bring about by that relation. That condition is always missed, and so the happiness expected never comes. Nava are jayai kamaya jaya priya bhavati atmanastu kamaya jaya priya bhavati nava are putra nam kamaya putra priya bhavati atmanastu kamaya putra priyam bhavanti nava are vittasya kamaya vittam priyam bhavati atmanastu kamaya vittam priyam bhavati nava are brahmana kamaya brahma priyam bhavati atmanastu kamaya brahma priyam bhavati nava are kshatrasya kamaya kshatram priyam bhavati atmanastu kamaya kshatram priyam bhavati नवा अरे लोकानाम कामाय लोका प्रिया भवन्ति आत्मनस्तु कामाय लोका प्रिया भवन्ति नवा अरे देवानाम कामाय देवा प्रिया भवन्ति आत्मनस्तु कामाय देवा प्रिया भवन्ति नवा अरे भूतानाम कामाय भूतानि प्रियानि भवन्ति आत्मनस्तु कामाय भूतानि प्रियानि भवन्ति नवा अरे सर्वस्य कामाय सर्वं प्रियं भवति. आफ्टर एनुमरेटिंग सो मेनी थिंग्स दैट कैन बी कंसीव्ड इन दिस वर्ल्ड एज नॉट बीइंग द सोर्स ऑफ रियल सैटिस्फैक्शन टू अ पर्सन, ही सेज nothing can give you happiness. Because it is not anything that is the source of happiness, but it is something else which you are always missing due to a confusion of thought. Nava are sarvasya kamaya sarvam priyam bhavati. Atmanastu kamaya sarvam priyam bhavati. For the sake of the infinitude of being which is the self, everything appears to be desirable. Here the word Atman is to be understood in the sense of the totality of being. It is the selfhood of all beings, a great subject which we have studied in detail in the fourth session of the first chapter. For the sake of the supreme absolute, which is the self of all things, you are asking for things. You have missed the point in asking for the things of the world. So it is a wild goose chase from birth to death, nothing forthcoming. Ultimately, you came crying and you go crying because you have missed the whole point in the tremendous efforts that you have put forth throughout your life, sweating and toiling for nothing. Atmanastu kamaya sarvam priyam bhavati. Atma va are drashtavya. Maitreyi, it is the Atman that is to be beheld. It is the Atman that is to be known. It is the Atman that is to be searched for, and that is the Atman which is to be heard about. It is the Atman that is to be thought in the mind. It is the Atman that is to be meditated upon. There is nothing else worthwhile thinking, nothing else worthwhile possessing, because nothing worthwhile exists other than this. Nididhyastavyaha maitreyi atmanova are darshanena Shravanena Matya Vijnanena Idam Sarvamitam. If you can grasp the significance of what this Atman is, you have known everything. And then you have possessed everything. You have become all things. There is nothing left afterwards. And if this is not to be achieved, what is going to be your fate? Suppose you don't have this knowledge. Everything shall leave you one day or the other. Today this goes, tomorrow that goes. And history of humanity has told us repeatedly that you cannot trust upon anything. You have seen things coming and things going, and today it is there, tomorrow it is not there. You cannot know what will happen tomorrow and what will be the status and stage of things at any moment of time. Everything shall desert a person who is bereft of this knowledge. Because they are not a part of his being. How can they be with him always? That which is not you cannot be possessed by you. That which is not you really cannot be a property of you. That which is not you cannot be with you. And therefore it shall leave you. So why do you cry if something goes away? And there is bereavement, loss, etc. It is quite natural. It is exactly as things ought to be. Things which are outside you do not belong to you. Therefore they should leave you. What is the difficulty? What is the problem? And why are you worrying about it? If they become you, they cannot leave you. Because you cannot be dispossessed of yourself. You are dispossessed only of those things which are not yours. This point you don't understand. So the Upanishad says, Brahmatam Paradas. Ya anyatratmana brahma veda, etc., etc. The same repetition of the subject. Finally saying, sarvam tampara das, yonyatratmana sarvam veda. Everything shall leave you if you regard anything as other than you. This is a metaphysical point, a psychological theme, and a practical truth. You cannot forget this. Anything that is outside you cannot satisfy you, and therefore it shall leave you. So it shall bring you sorrow. It is a point which is eternally true. Sarvam tam paradad yonyatra atmana sarvam veda. All things shall desert you one day or the other. Even those things which you regard dearest and nearest and most desirable and valuable shall desert you, leave you, because they do not belong to you. Anyatra atmana sarvam veda. Idam brahma, idam chatra, ime loka, ime deva, imani bhutani, idam sarvam yadayam atma. So, Maitreyi says Yajnavalkya, it is this Atman that appears as all these things, which point is never grasped by the mind which looks upon objects as independent entities. It is the one reality that masquerades in the form of various forms and names. But this point is not understood. The mind that is finite and located and lodged in the body does not understand the fact that finite objects that are outside are appearances of a single indivisible reality. So the finite clings to the finite, not knowing this fact of infinitude that is at the background of these finite forms. If this infinitude that is at the base of these finite forms is to be understood, realized, and made part of one's own being, then realization accrues. This Atman is all. Idam sarvam yadayam atma. Sa yatha. Now an illustration is given. By three illustrations, Yajnavalkya tells us that an effect cannot be known unless the cause is known. Because the effect is a manifestation of the cause in some proportion. You cannot understand the nature of any object in this world unless you know where from it has come. But we try to understand the why and wherefore of things merely beholding them with naked eyes. Whatever be the extent of your observation in the minutest laboratory conceivable in the world, you cannot understand things. Because whatever is observed through even the subtlest instrument, even the best microscope, whatever you see, it is an effect, it is not a cause. It is a product of certain other circumstances. The conditions that have been responsible for the effectuation of this form that you are observing are transcendent and therefore they are invisible. Unless the cause behind the form that is visible is perceived, the form cannot be known. If you are intent upon knowing the nature of any object, you must know its relation to something else. And that something else is connected to another thing. And so on and so forth, until you will be surprised to realize that everything is connected to everything. And in such a way that nothing can be known, unless everything is known. So, it is not possible to have a complete knowledge of any finite object unless the infinite itself is known. You cannot know the structure of even a sand particle in the beach unless the whole cosmos is known, ultimately. Because it has got infinite relationships with various types of atmosphere of which it is a product. So it will take you up to the limit of the infinite if you try to understand the inner inscrutable majesty of even a grain of sand. So for this purpose, the great master Yajnavalkya gives us three illustrations. Just as the sound that is made by a percussion instrument cannot be properly understood if the instrument itself is far away, like a mridanga or a nagari or a tabla or whatever it is, some sort of instrument which is not visible to the eyes but whose sound is heard by you from a distance. Just as the finite notes of the beating of the drum will not enable you to understand the rhythm of the whole series of notes produced by the beating of the drum unless you catch the source thereof. Just as you cannot know the rhythm produced by the blowing of a conch unless you have the capacity to grasp the totality of the sound by actually perceiving the conch that is blown at any particular time. Just as you cannot understand the symphony produced by a veena or a stringed instrument, for instance, merely by hearing one note, unless you are able to connect all the notes together in a harmonious symphony, so is the case with all these things in this world. You cannot know anything. They are like one note in the symphony or the music of the universe. So how can you know the beauty of music by hearing only one note? That note is connected to many other notes. You know very well there is a harmony. And when every note is harmoniously related to all other notes to which it is related, and all the notes are grasped at one stroke in one single harmonious symphony, that becomes music. It is so beautiful. But if one twang is heard or one tick is heard, it makes no sense. It is not a music. Likewise is any object in this world. It is one twang, one tick, one sound which is really connected to a vast arena or gamut of symphony that is universally expansive. Unless that total expanse or continuity is grasped by the mind at one stroke, it means to say that unless the infinite being behind the finite objects is grasped by the consciousness, no finite object can be known fully, nothing can be understood perfectly, therefore nothing can bring you satisfaction, so no hope of immortality through any possession in this world is the conclusion of sage Yajnavalkya.
It was said that the nature of effect cannot be known unless their cause is known. It is futile on our part to investigate into the nature of any finite object without correlating its form and context with the causes which range behind its present form in a series which cannot be comprehended by the mind. as every link in a chain is connected with every other link, and the pull or force exerted by the topmost link may be felt by the lowermost link, even if the chain may be millions of miles in long length, irrespective of the fact that the lowest link might not have even seen the very existence of the topmost link, the presence of that topmost link will be felt by the pressure it exerts through the age-long length of the chain, of which the lowermost link is a finite part. Something like that is the nature of all finite things in the world, and we cannot understand the nature of anything unless we are in a position to understand everything at the same time. Either you know everything or you know nothing. That is the truth of all experience. There is no such thing as knowing something, because that something is a false abstraction from the organic connections with which it is related. Minus with relations, its very existence is not worth a cognition at all. The nature of finite objects is very peculiar. They are constituted of the circumstances in which they are placed, so that you cannot separate the circumstances from the nature of the thing by itself. It is not true that circumstances are outside and the thing is inside. This is a false abstraction again, which the mind makes in its untutored attitude towards things. The circumstances are a part of the existence of a thing, and these circumstances are not mere conceptual notions in the mind. They are vital energies, powers. Even space is not an emptiness, as you know very well. It is as solid as the heaviest of rocks, because under conditions which can be experimented upon, even the most solid of things can be converted into an ethereal substance. So that the atmosphere, the circumstance of space around objects, is not an unimportant role that is played on the existence of an object. But the incapacity of the senses to perceive non-physical objects and non-physical conditions creates a false impression in the mind that the circumstances are completely isolated from the existence of an object. This is why we make independent notional judgments about things, disconnecting them from the conditions in which we are involved, which are ultimately cosmic conditions. The point made out in the Upanishad, in this passage we studied last time, is that without the knowledge of the Absolute, not even the smallest of things can be understood. Sa yathardehidagrihe abhyahitat prithak dhuma vinicharanti. Now the next passage tells us everything proceeds from the Absolute. Proceeds in a very peculiar manner again, not easily understandable by individual minds. So, the manner in which things are supposed to proceed from the Supreme Being can be explained only through certain analogies, by comparison, by visible examples. All knowledge is a partial aspect of the Supreme Absolute. It is knowledge itself. It is not knowledge in the sense of an information about things, but the very existence of all things, which is inseparable from the knowledge of things. And so, any knowledge or wisdom that is worth mentioning is a fraction, as it were, a spark, as it were, a ray, as it were, a part, as it were, of the Supreme Absolute. Even the foremost geniuses of the world cannot be compared with the ray of that supernal fecundity of knowledge. Everything comes from that. How does this come? We cannot understand how a thing can come from the Absolute. We can only give some analogical, comparative illustrations, and the Upanishad employs here the comparison of smoke arising from fire, for instance. Just as when you burn wet fuel, smoke may rise from its burning process. Everything may be said to proceed in this manner, as it were, from the Supreme Being. A continuous emanation. It is called the theory of emanation. And that which emanates has the substantial character of that from which it emanates. We have always to remember what we have studied earlier, that the nature of the cause is always present in the existence of the effect. So the effect, which is knowledge, is a fractional appearance of the plenum of wisdom, which is the Parabrahman, the Absolute. Everything comes from that. Asya mahato bhutasya nesya siddhanesat. From the aspiration, as it were, of this eternal infinite reality, all this knowledge of this world has come. Just as you breathe out and there is a breath coming from your nostrils, the Absolute breathes, as it were, this wisdom of all this creation. And all this wisdom of the world put together cannot be equated with a fraction of it, which will be another aspect of this mystery which will be mentioned in the following passage. The wisdom of the Vedas, which is regarded as eternal knowledge, can be compared to the aspiration of the Absolute. Yadrugvedo, Yajurveda, Samavedo, Atharvangirasa, Rigvaji, Sama, Atharva, all the four Vedas and all that is contained in them, anything that is implied in the Vedas, the eternity that is embosomed in the Vedas, all this is an emanation from the Absolute. And what else? Everything that is of that nature and everything that is capable of being connected with the Vedic knowledge, such as Itihasa, Purana, Vidya, all arts and branches of learning, secret teachings, verses, and poetic compositions, aphorisms, commentaries, anything that you can call knowledge, in whatever way, whatever manner, whatever form, all that is contained there. Everything has come from there. Asyeva etani sarvani nishchitani. The substantiality of all that can be regarded as of highest value in the world is the substantiality of that magnificent being, mahato bhutasya asya nishvasitam. The breath, as it were, of this eternal breathless reality is this vast manifestation. As everything that can be considered as an effect is located in the cause in some way or the other, so are all things located in the Absolute in some way or the other. This is interestingly stated in a longish passage that follows. Svayatha sarvasa mapam samudra ekayatanam. The ocean is the repository of all waters. Every water can be found in the ocean. Evam sarvesham sparshanam tvadhikayavan ayatanam. The touch sense and everything that we regard as meaningful from the point of view of tangibility is located in the skin. Sarvesham rasanam jihva ekayatanam. every kind of taste can be located ultimately in the structural pattern of the tongue or the palate. Sarvesham gandhanam nasike ekayatam. Every smell, every odor, every type of fragrance is located in the structure of the nostrils ultimately. Sarvesham rupanam chakshur ekayatanam. Every color, every form, everything that is visible is located in the structure of the eyes ultimately. Sarvesham shabdanam shrotram ekayatanam. Every sound, whatever it be, is located in the structure of the ears ultimately. Sarvesham sankalpanam mana ekayatanam. Every thought, every feeling, anything that is cogitated is ultimately located in the structure of the mind of a human being. Sarvesham vidyanam hridayam ekayatanam. Every feeling, every kind of intimation connected with knowledge of ultimate things is the heart of a person ultimately. Evam sarvesham karmanam hastam ekayatanam. Every action, the capacity to grasp, etc., is located in the energies of the hands of the person. Evam sarvesham, other organs also are mentioned in this manner, making out that all activities of the senses are capable of being traced back to the structure of the senses. So that if you know the nature of the sense organ concerned in any particular action, whether it is the action of knowledge or merely of locomotion, etc., you can know everything connected with that particular organ. Likewise, you can know all things if you can locate their origin. From where they proceed ultimately. Again, we have to recapitulate what we have studied last time, that it is not an easy affair to go back to the cause of a thing. Because we may be able to perceive the immediate cause of any particular phenomenon, but the ultimate cause cannot easily be discovered. Because we are limited to the capacities of the mind and the sense organs. And whatever the mind can think and the senses can cognize or perceive, these only are the realities to us as human beings. So even the manifest investigation into the nature of the cause of any phenomenon or event or object cannot be regarded as ultimate, because the ultimate cannot be comprehended by the mind or the senses due to their own limitations to space and time. But if it could be possible in some mysterious manner, if the ultimate cause could be discovered, then you would be at once in the presence of a flash of illumination wherein everything will be presented before the mind's eye instantaneously, at one stroke as it were. Sa yatha saindhava khilya udake prasta udaka mevanu viliyeta. Another illustration is given here to make out the nature of the Supreme Being from whom all knowledge proceeds. If you dissolve a little piece of salt in water, what happens is salt becomes one with the water. You may take any part of that water, it tastes salty. And you cannot find out where the salt is. It has become one with the water. It is everywhere in the water. Sa ha asya udgrahanaya siyat na yat yatayat yato yatasvadadita lavanameva. Evam va are idam mahadbhutam anantam aparam. Just as any part of that water in which salt is dissolved will taste salt only, because of the pervasive character of the salt that has got dissolved into the water, so is this infinite being. How?
idam mahadbhutam anantam aparam vijnana ghana eva. This is a mass of knowledge. It is a solidity of wisdom. It is a substantiality of what you regard as the highest consciousness. That is this ultimate reality. Wherever you touch, it is that which is touched. And wherever you taste anything, you are tasting that only. And anything that is seen, it is naturally that which is seen and nothing else. Whatever be the corresponding object of a particular sense organ, it is a form of that which is seen. And the mind thinks nothing but that, not knowing it is thinking that. Vijnana ghana eva etebhyo bhutebhya samuthaya tanyevanu vinashyati na pritya samjnasti. This consciousness which is a solid reality ultimately, the substantiality of the whole universe, appears to localize itself in a body of individuals by entering into the process of the permutation and combination of the elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, etc. A particular combination in some percentage of these five elements becomes a body, an embodiment. When consciousness enters this particular formation of the elements, it is what we call the individual, the jiva, or a particular finite body. It arises in this form and dissolves itself in this form as it were, as long as it is connected to this formation of the elements. The birth of the individual and the death of the individual are described here as being the consequence of the association of consciousness with the formation of the five elements in certain proportion. It is the elements, the five elements, which combine in certain ways under different conditions that are responsible for the objects of sense, as we call them. Animate or inanimate, whatever they be, all the objects, all the bodies are really the elements in some shape, in color and tangibility. They appear to have a value and worth and meaning because of the entry of consciousness into them. And when the formation changes, there is a different type of formation of the elements, that is called the death of the individual. It is not really a death really, it is a re-transformation, a reformation of the particular form into which these elements have been cast by the need of that unit of consciousness which is called the jiva. When this consciousness gets entangled in the forms of the elements, it is called birth of the individual. When it is freed from them, it is called liberation of the individual. When it is freed from the elements, it will not be conscious of any particular thing. Na pretya samjnasi. Yajnavalkya tells Maitreyi, when there is a total isolation of consciousness from all its associations in the form of these permutations and combination of elements called the body, there would be no particularized consciousness. There would be no seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, nothing particular whatsoever. No consciousness at all. So bluntly says Yajnavalkya without commenting on the meaning of this statement. After dissolution, there is no awareness. This is what is meant by this pithi statement, na pretya samjnasi. Are bravimiti ho vaja Yajnavalkya Maitreyi, this I tell you, and try to understand what I tell you. Maitreyi is surprised. How is it? You are saying that it is an ocean of wisdom, a mass of knowledge, substantiality of everything that is consciousness. And now you say there is no consciousness. When there is an absorption of consciousness into itself and freedom from its entanglement in the elements, you say it knows nothing. How is it possible that it knows nothing while it is all knowledge? You do not understand what I say.
Tell Yajnavalkya to Maitreyi. I have not confused you by saying this. Nor have I mystified you in this your so-called contradictory statement. Your idea of knowledge is misconstrued. You have your own definition of knowledge. And from that point of view, from that standard of the judgment of knowledge, you seem to perceive a contradiction in my statement that after freedom from entanglement, there is no consciousness. In spite of the fact, it is an ocean of consciousness. Our concept of knowledge is well known. It is the frog's knowledge, it is the ass's knowledge, it is the donkey's, it is the animalistic perception that we call usually call knowledge, the contact of the mind with objects. In a particular manner, under given conditions, is called knowledge. But this knowledge comes and goes according to the circumstances of the object of particular knowledge of the senses. So to us, knowledge means knowledge of something. This connecting link of is very important. Whenever we speak of knowing, we always say knowing what? So there must be something which is known. And we speak of knowledge of something, studying something, awareness of something, illumination of something, everything of something. So we are always accustomed to connect knowledge with a content or object which is apparently external to knowledge. This strange relationship between object and the knowledge of that object is the subject of a philosophical controversy known as the conflict between the idealistic and the realistic theories. How does knowledge arise is a very great subject in philosophy. Whether it arises by the location of the object in a particular manner, is it the object that is responsible for the knowledge of the object, or is it the mind that knows the object that is responsible for the knowledge of the object? Well, this is a subject outside our discussion today. So Yajnavalkya tells, your notion of knowledge is involved in the concept of the isolation of the object of knowledge from knowledge. So that there cannot be knowledge unless there is an object. And when I tell you that there is no such thing as knowledge of an object in that condition where consciousness is absolved completely from all contact with the formation of the element, you are not able to understand what I am saying. Why? Yatra idvai tamiva bhavati sarita raitaram pashyati. Where there is an object of knowledge, well, naturally it can be known. Yes. Where there is something outside the eye can see. Sarita raitaram jigrati. Where there is something outside the nose can smell. That is true. Where the sound is outside the ear can hear the sound. Where the spoken through is outside the speech itself, one can speak about something. Where the thought is different from the object that is thought, it is possible to think. Where the object of understanding is different from the understanding, it is possible to understand that object. Yatra va asya sarva bhati va bhutu. Where understanding only is and the object of understanding is not there, what is it that you understand? If this situation could be envisaged for the time being, if a condition can be conceived where the object of knowledge has melted into the knowledge itself, what could be the knowledge which one can be endowed with? That which is to be known has melted into the knowledge. It has become part of the knowledge. So knowledge is
filled with the substance of the object which it knows. How can you say that there is knowing anything? Because that anything which you speak of as the object of knowledge has become knowledge itself. So no such thing as knowing anything, and therefore it is Maitreya, I said, no such thing as knowing there exists and it does not know anything. Sarvam Atmi Vabhut, where everything is the self of knowledge. What does that self know? Except its own self. Kenakam Pashyet, Kenakam Jidret, Kenakam Srunayat, Kenakam Abhivadetat, Kenakam Manvitatat, Kenakam Vijaniyat. Who is to see what, where the object of perception has become a part and parcel of the process of perception itself? Yenedam Sarvam Vijanati, Tam Kena Vijaniyat. Everything is known by the knower. But who is to know the knower? If the knower is to be known, there must be a second knower to that knower, and the second knower can be known by the third by the fourth by the fifth. You go on scratching your head, you cannot know the knower. How can the knower be known? Because you already designated the knower as a knower, and you cannot call him known now. Therefore, there is no such thing as knowing of knowing or knowing of knower. Knowing of object only is there. That object which is known has become part of knowledge. It has become one with the knower. When knower alone is, there is no such thing as knowing. Therefore it is, I told you, Maitreyi, it is not possible to have cognition and perception and mentation and understanding in the usual sense in that absolute which is supernal felicity of plenum. Now, this subject is continued later on in the Yajnavalkya Kanda of the same Upanishad. It abruptly stops here and takes over into a new subject which has some remote connection but not immediate connection. The immediately connected passage will occur later on, yad vaitanna pashyati pashyan, vaitanna pashyati, etc. Yajnavalkya will be teaching the Emperor Janaka, where he says, where I tell you that it does not see anything, it does not mean that it does not see anything, it sees everything. While it does not know anything, it knows everything, while it does not see everything, it sees everything, etc., etc. Will be mentioned later on as a sort of an exposition of this mystical statement of Yajnavalkya in this particular Brahmana known as the Maitreyi Brahmana. Now, a subject that is in a way connected with this topic is taken up in the subsequent section. The reason why you cannot have perceptual knowledge or cognitional awareness in the totality of things is because of the fact everything is connected with everything in that knowledge. You cannot look upon something and judge a thing independently in a condition where everything is connected with everything. You cannot have a standard of judgment in a situation where that which is judged has become one with the standard of judgment itself. This interdependence of things and interconnectedness of values is discussed in a very famous aspect of Brahadaranyaka knowledge called the Madhuitya, which is supposed to be given by Sage Dajjali.